We want to say welcome to everybody. In the first hour, I told a story that fits better in that hour than it does in this hour. But I decided, in the spirit of giving you all a chance to hear some of the things that happen in both hours. The story that I heard was, a fellow was driving his car. His wife was sitting next to him. His mother-in-law was in the back seat. This is not autobiographical. And every time his wife would say, "You're going too slow, speed up, turn left," his mother-in-law would say, "You're going too fast, slow down, turn right." And after a few miles of this, he stops his car in the middle of traffic, turns to his wife and says, "We need to get it straight right now. Who's driving this car? Is it you or is it your mother?" I just thought that was a hoot.
And why do you think that wouldn't be relevant for us?
Well, I don't see any issues there. That's not an issue that I have. I don't see any of you all having no issue. But you might recognize somebody. Now, we've been looking for a number of weeks, and this is for you all who are visiting. We've been looking for a number of weeks at characteristics of servants as the Bible records that. T.W. Hunt, an author that some of you know, a couple of things he's written, looked at this. And in the King James Version of the Bible, 14 times in the New Testament, the word servant appears with an adjective or a modifier or a descriptor term. And so we've been walking through those. We're in the second half of that study, and we have come to 2 Timothy chapter 2, where in a single verse we find four of these, and in the verse that follows that verse we find one more. So there's five of these 14 characteristics all in one place. We've looked at the first four of these, and it's time now to look at the fifth one. For several weeks, I have been sharing with you the context of this by starting a little bit earlier than the verse that we focus on. The verse that has those in it is verse 24. I've always found if I pretend something didn't happen that maybe nobody else will notice that it happened. Anyway, in verse 24, and so I backed up to verse 22 to read the context, and this is what I've read. "Turn away from the passions of youth, concentrate on uprightness, faith, love, and peace in union with all those who call on the Lord with a pure heart. Avoid foolish and undisciplined speculations, understanding that they only give rise to quarrels. And a servant of the Lord must not engage in quarrels, but must be kind to everyone, a good teacher, and patient. He must be gentle when he corrects people who oppose him in the hope that God may give them a change of mind so that they recognize the truth and come to their senses, escaping the trap of the devil who made them his captives and subjugated them to his will." What I'd like to do this morning is read that same thing out of another translation, and I'm going to read out of the New Living Translation. And this time I'm going to go just a little bit further, and so that you can see now for the first time the context on the other side of these verses. I've been having you back up a couple of verses. We're going to now go a few verses further. So, starting again at verse 22, if you want to follow along in your translation, "Run from anything that stimulates youthful passion. Follow anything that makes you want to do right. Pursue faith and love and peace, and enjoy the companionship of those who call on the Lord with pure hearts. I say it again, don't get involved in foolish, ignorant arguments that only start fights. The Lord's servants must not quarrel, but must be kind to everyone. They must be able to teach effectively and be patient with difficult people. They should gently teach those who oppose the truth. Perhaps God will change those people's hearts, and they will believe the truth. And then they will come to their senses and escape from the devil's trap, for they've been held captive by him to do whatever he wants." Now, continuing into chapter 3, you need to know this also, Timothy, Paul writes. "In the last days, there will be some very difficult times, for people will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God, disobedient to their parents, and ungrateful. They will consider nothing sacred. They will be unloving and unforgiving. They will slander others and have no self-control. They will be cruel and have no interest in what is good. They will betray their friends, be reckless, be puffed up with pride, and they will love pleasure rather than God. They will act as if they are religious, but they will reject the power that could make them godly. You need to stay away from people like that. Now, first of all, is his description of a world that might be coming accurate? Are we living in a world that has some of those characteristics? I think so. So now the question is, who are we supposed to stay away from? Is there a contrast between verse 25 of chapter 2, a servant of the Lord must be gentle when he corrects people who oppose him, and chapter 3, the tail end of verse 5, keep away from people like that? In the one case, you've got engagement. In the other case, you have separation. Which one are you supposed to do?
Your turn. What do you think? Yes, sir.
On the one hand, if their engagement with them is for their good or transmission of truth, to help them defend their grandparents, that's one thing. But if you involve your life with them by normal everyday social intercourse and seem to approve by doing so, you know, of their life, then that's probably the other side.
And I think that's the bulk of it. The one thing that I think sneaks in as well is if you have people who have come into a body of believers and are trying to lead them into things that are not what the Lord has us do, then some separation might be needed. If you have people who are interacting with, even if it's confrontational or opposition, but they're interacting, there is a way to engage that could be productive. So what I want to do is I want to investigate two things.
One is the focal point, which is the front of verse 25. He must be gentle. The King James translation uses the word meek. There's another translation, I think, that uses the word humble, but we have already had that in our list of 14. He must be gentle when he corrects people who oppose him. I want us to work on that. But before we do that, I want to make sure that we go back and pick up something in the context that I've been showing you every week that we haven't done anything with yet. The very first part of verse 22 says, turn away from the passions of youth. So my question is, what are the passions of youth? What are the things that they're suggesting that maybe aren't healthy, that might be characteristic of young people? What are some of those things? First hour did a pretty good job of setting up a few that might make that list. What do you think?
Partying.
Why would they party and drink?
Experimentation.
Susceptible. And if you don't like the way I spell that, you can spell it yourself. Peer pressure. Susceptible to peer pressure. And I think that leads to some of the things that you were talking about. But there's a second one hiding in that, and I don't think you should leave that.
The feeling of being invincible.
Short-sighted.
I was wondering whether you all would ever have anything in common with the first hour's list. This one's in common. Let me get that in just a second. Let me stay on this one back up here. When you talked about the drinking and all that kind of stuff, there's also the sense of a selfish seeking for, you know, things that gratify yourself. So you can almost read it in the first hour. Self-focused. Self-absorbed, and maybe something like that. Now, somebody said another word.
Self-gratification.
Yeah, I think that was it.
I said experimentation. I said short-sighted. Can't think how you've been.
Short-sighted and
curiosity.
Yeah, somebody said curiosity, and you said
experimentation.
Experimentation.
And there's a link between the two, but I want to point something out to you in just a second. Curiosity. Willing to... experiment. I put down immature physically, emotionally, and mentally. One of those doesn't belong.
Physically.
Yeah, that's a lot less of a problem anymore, if it ever was. And maybe it's a problem if they aren't. Yeah. That maybe they mature too fast.
See how it grows the brain.
Yeah, I want to make it clear, if you agree with me, all right. I want to propose that the immaturity in some parts and a sort of advancing too quickly in other parts and everything sort of out of sync and out of whack. But impulsive. Now, I think we're far enough along now for me to ask a question. Do you find this list positive or negative?
I had that thought. It's negative. But I was thinking the youthful passion is enthusiasm and energy and excitement about all that they do. I mean, that part is
almost envy. What I want to do is I want to make sure that we...
Because I don't think curious is a bad thing. It's just being curious is indulgent.
And that's all I want to do is make sure that everybody recognizes there is a tendency as you get older and look back to cast things negative. This one wasn't cast negatively. That's why it was so interesting. This one is neutral. Several of these are negatively focused, but hiding in them is something that isn't negative. And so my question is, having put together sort of an instinctive list, can you now go back and take a closer look at it and maybe draw out of it, what are the positives that might be here? So, energy.
Well, there's kind of the flip side of the impulsive, the negative impulsiveness is kind of the positive spontaneity.
Well, you know, and that feeling invincible is not necessarily negative either, because it's like they don't perceive any barriers to what they want to do.
Right.
Well, it's like kids with the computers, they're fearless. Yeah. A certain degree of...
willingness to take risks, to try new things, and to succeed when they do.
Even the peer pressure doesn't have to always be positive or negative. Depending on who your peers are and what they're doing.
Yeah. Even there.
I think about my daughter too. She just got from one of her grandmother's drama for the thing, drama queen. Yeah, we'll push her frame in it. But it's like, you know, she's so emotional. I mean, you know, it's just that those emotions, and it's like not trying to squelch them all, but trying to corral them and put them in a, you know.
Somebody, yeah, I heard a word just a second ago, and it didn't get repeated.
Passion.
And I don't know if I heard the word exuberant or if I heard the word enthusiastic, but I heard one of those two words. I'd like to put both of those up. All the trouble is I don't know how to spell exuberant. And if that H doesn't belong, then you take it out. There's an enthusiasm, there's an exuberance, there's a spontaneity, there's an energy. And those are not bad things.
Where does the tension come in the body of believers? Can you see it now? If you're a leader, what needs to characterize you? Because Paul is writing to Timothy. Timothy is a pupil, if you will, of Paul. He is learning ministry from Paul as his mentor. And Paul is saying to him, look, you are physically still young, but you need to make a transition from freewheeling, don't worry about anything, spur of the moment kind of stuff, into something more thoughtful, something that looks long range rather than short range. And yet, if you take a look, he begins to work on things that do make you able to talk about what kinds of things happen within a group and what is experience supposed to bring to the table and what is youth supposed to bring to the table.
What is experience supposed to bring to the table? What is youth supposed to bring to the table?
Sometimes easier to see the problems that youth brings. And it won't take you very long. You wouldn't have looked at that list another 5 minutes before beginning to realize, you know, wait a minute, we need to go back and recast that. And the question is, how do you work this out?
And if you listen, what he says is, he mustn't engage in quarrels, but must be kind to everyone. A good teacher and patient. Gentle when he corrects people who oppose him, in the hope that God may give them a change of mind. There's a guy named Barclay. Some of you will know about him. He has written commentaries on the New Testament. And here's what he says. If you think about the things that are not good in youthful passions, here's his list. Here's his list, and you can line this up against your list. The first one he said was impatience. The second was self-assertion, and he commented that this hides arrogance. When you're thinking about the opinions of others, you tend to be intolerant towards other people's opinions. You tend to be arrogant in the expression of your own opinions. There's not a sense of a willingness to listen to the opinions of others and sort of work to find the best in both and synthesize those. Self-absorption, you haven't learned how to see good in others or maybe good points in others in comparison to the good points you see in yourself. The love of argument, which seems never to seek resolution. Let's just fight some more. There's a comic strip that's running right now, and I can't remember the title of it, but in the Richmond newspaper, it's on the top of the left-hand column of the right-hand page. It's either For Better or Worse or one of those. Have you been reading that strip the last few days? Two little kids in the family, and they are fighting like cats and dogs. And the mom and the dad find a solution. And the solution is separate bedrooms. They rearrange all the stuff in their house so they clear out two different bedrooms where the kids can be separated from one another so that at night they won't fight each other. So the first night comes, the little kids are supposed to go off to their separate bedrooms. And the parents say, sounds like it's worked. We don't hear any fussing and fighting. And go upstairs, and what do they find? Those of you who've seen the strip. Both kids are in the same room. Fought like crazy when they had to be in the same room. Now they could be in different rooms. They found a way to avoid that. Sometimes, you know, you find people fight just for the fun of fighting. And you're not really seeking resolution. And then he says something else that you haven't exactly put up here, but I think it's hiding in this. He talks about the love of novelty. That's the way he phrases it, the love of novelty, which often condemns what is old solely because it is old, what embraces or promotes what is new solely because it is new. And connected to that, some things you haven't talked about but they sort of come out of impulsive, is the desire for instant gratification. I think you talked about short-sightedness, you know, taking a long-term. My wife is a kindergarten teacher, and one of the big lessons that they have every year is the lesson that talks about the difference between what I want and what I need, and helping the children begin to articulate actual needs as needs and things that they want as wants. That's very hard, because if you argue that you need it, then, you know, it's a more powerful argument. You might think that you get it more likely. But hiding in that is some of that. Now, what he says, though, is all of this is arising out of fresh and intense vision. It's a different vision from what maybe the older people would have. And if there is not a tension between these two, probably the body is not strong. So you don't want to condemn it.
You want to find a way to work with it. If you're older, you might recognize that a willingness to take risk is something that maybe you ought to do a little more often than you do. Willingness to try new things. Like I told you last week about something my wife said, and before she had finished saying it, I said no 3 times. At the same time, I think having somebody who does think about longer range things is healthy too. So he's talking, I think, about a balance here. What did John Upton say about this church in this connection? Did he say the same things with you
that he said with us?
He said, this is a church that's willing to take risks. As he said that, I found myself thinking,
if I go back about 5 years, I could probably think without trying too hard of 5 things, fairly big things, that this church tried and failed. We tried to set up a mission partnership in Estonia. Pretty big deal for this church. Didn't work. We tried to work out a partnership with a church that was not very strong and wanted to partner with us. And we, I think, went into it properly, and they had second thoughts and backed out of it. But I started to think about the things that we took risks on, and we were successful. And without thinking too hard, I think I got to 20 or 25 and probably could have gotten further if I'd worked at it. There are churches out there that aren't willing to take risks. There's some churches that take no risks at all. I think you could probably get to a point where the church takes, or a body of some kind, takes more risks than it ought to. But being willing to try new things is something that we have been doing here. Not always without opposition. So, he then summarizes those 4 things that we've already talked about as not involved in senseless controversies. What's the implication? There might be some controversies that aren't senseless that maybe we should engage in those. Kind and concerned even when providing correction. But what about teaching? It says not just knowing the truth, but able to communicate the truth. And I found myself thinking about my students. I told my students as recently as Friday, if you really want to understand chemistry, if you really want to have things under good control, the thing to do is find somebody else who needs to learn them and teach them. Within 3 minutes, you will probably know whether you know that subject or not. And if you don't do that, you can go weeks without knowing, not until a test comes or something like that. The act of speaking to another human being, trying to articulate in your own words what some ideas or concepts are, very often brings into focus either, yes, I do know this and I do have something, or makes it clear, maybe there's a little more I need to know here. Students who've tried that tell me it works, and I'm pretty sure it works with me. And then finally, able to accept injury or insult without retaliation, able to deal with slights and humiliations with grace and poise. And today the subject comes, how do you encounter people who oppose you? Barclay's words is able to interact. He uses the word interact with such folks with gentle firmness, focusing on the problem and not on the people with the problem. Focusing on the problem or the question or the issue and not on the people with the question or with the issue. Now,
that's sort of enough of background. My next question, which is now exploring this one, is why do you think people oppose? If you have a person of faith and they're trying to live that faith and they begin to experience opposition, where do you think that opposition comes from? Why do you think there is opposition?
Preconceived ideas.
Okay.
Why? What else?
Lack of knowledge.
Lack of knowledge? Say it again.
We've done it before.
Uh-huh. I don't think any of you have hit it yet.
Misunderstanding.
Yeah.
There's a threat of some kind. I think that's the one that you want to focus on. Why is there opposition? If you didn't care, you wouldn't oppose. If you didn't care, you wouldn't oppose. Now, what's the...
That one person that opposes everything.
I will set that aside as an exception with you.
Yeah.
I heard somebody say once, a college professor by definition is the person who thinks otherwise. Whatever you say, I think otherwise. What's threatened? I'm not sure this is the best word to get into where I'm trying to take you, but it'll do it.
The number of them would be a principle.
Or a value system from which your principles emerge.
You make balance that's threatened.
Yeah. My world view, the way that I look at things, you're making me question that.
I feel uncomfortable. It could be denial. They want to say it.
If I don't oppose it, then I might have to change something. Because I keep it the way it is. Where did those things come from? I'm now where I was trying to go. What was that feeling of denial or that feeling of maybe I'll have to change something if I let this thing stand unchallenged?
Selfishness.
You have to self-examine your own beliefs as to why you believe what you believe.
Why would you examine yourself?
If you're being asked to change or be part of a change, maybe you don't know enough about why you believe what you believe. It's just what you were taught, and you can't even fully explain it, and that causes you discomfort.
This won't be the only example, and it may be a fairly narrow example, but try it on for size. Someone is simply living a life of faith before the world. They're just doing what the life of faith calls them to do. They're not confronting anybody. They're just living. And opposition arises. That's not happening much here, but it's happening in other parts of the world and can be brutal when it happens. Where's that coming from? And the assertion that I would suggest that you think about for a minute is, you don't get that level of opposition if God is not at work in the people where the opposition is arising. And I think that's what stands behind Paul's words. Can you now go back and re-examine that whole verse with me? A servant of God must be gentle when he corrects people who oppose him in the hope that what? Not that their minds might be changed. That's not what it says. What does he say? That God might give them. My translation says a change of mind. I think New Living said change of heart. So that they recognize the truth, parentheses, for the first time, close parentheses, and come to their senses. And therefore, what's the rest of it? Escape the trap. Let's celebrate. My son came home. What words did the father use? He was dead. He's alive again. He was lost. He's been found. Why did his son oppose his father? Why did his son want to go so far away? I don't want to have to look at the standard that I'm not meeting. He may not have been able to articulate it himself. But either you leave it, you get away from it, or you oppose it. He must be gentle when he corrects people who oppose him. In the hope. Now, I'm going to reword it, and that's a dangerous thing to do. But I think Paul might have worded it this way equally validly. That God might finish his work of changing their minds. Finish his work of helping them recognize the truth. Finish his work of bringing them to their senses. Finish his work of helping them escape. If you see opposition that way, is it as radically different as I think it is? You see what I'm saying? Even the most harsh opposition sometimes is a signal that God is at work in somebody's heart. And their first step is denial, or their first step is, I can't go that way. Everything would have to change if I did that. How did Jesus handle people that opposed him? Once or twice he was harsh. What's an example? In the temple with the money changers. Pretty harsh that day. There was a day when he was with the religious leaders, and you can almost hear his finger stuck out on that one. Woe to you, alas to you. And he was full of scathing criticism for that group. But there aren't very many cases like that. But there's a bunch of cases where he was encountering people who were opposing him, and his answers are gentle. They are not wishy-washy, but his answers are gentle. And the one that came to my mind was when a Pharisee invited him to dinner. And you realize as you read the story, there was a studious insult that was given to Jesus when he came in. The usual welcoming signals, washing his feet, giving him some oil for his head. Okay? Those kinds of things that you did, greeting him with a kiss, the Pharisee had avoided doing any of those. And so here he was at table, and the people from the town had crowded around, and there was a woman who ended up standing at Jesus' feet. And as Jesus spoke, she started to cry. And her tears fell on Jesus' feet. And in her embarrassment, I suspect, she took her hair and wiped off his feet. But hair wasn't supposed to be down for women unless they were signaling that they were prostitutes. And the Pharisee says to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know what kind of woman this is who's touching him. And you follow that story from that point on, and you find moment after moment, Jesus is dealing tenderly with the woman. But if you think about it, he's dealing pretty gently with the guy that invited him to supper that night too. Why? In the hope that God might give him a change of mind so that he could recognize the truth and come to his senses and escape the trap. The list for today is those four things. God is at work bringing people a change of heart, bringing people a recognition of the truth, bringing people to their senses, to a right view of things, to God's view of how things work and how things are, and thereby helping them to escape the trap. When we find opposition in spiritual matters, very often that opposition is arising because God's at work, or at least I believe that to be the case. And the outcome of that, change. If you can see that, it changes your reaction to opposition, and it changes it completely. Do you understand what I'm saying? I wrote this down after I read what Barclay had said. People of this sort, people who are able to interact with opponents with gentle firmness, focusing on the problem and not on the people with the problem. People of this sort stand ready, anxious even, to welcome those who respond to God's call. And a church without such people in it is going to find its doors were closed to those God may be working on most to bring them in. You said it yourself a little while ago, Russell. There were some people ready to celebrate, but it wasn't all. How ready are we to celebrate? How ready are we to gently correct? Recognizing we may need a little correction ourselves. The testing of what we think spiritually against opposition is going to strengthen us as well. And we may find ourselves adjusting a little as some of those encounters bring us new insights. But at the end of the day, God works through moments like this. Watch carefully the religious leaders in the world around you. Watch the ones who condemn their opponents. And watch the ones who speak gently about their opponents. There's a contrast, and it's not very hard to see if you watch for it.
And working with young people.
I do know that.
Who have the atrophy
in the negative.
Yes. How we manage that impacts them. There's probably a lot of kids, some of ours included, who aren't in church because of how they were managed by adult leaders and youth. Not with love and patience, but by making an example of them instead. To make them personal.
And their peers watch that too. Mm-hmm.
And so if they made a mistake, they were ostracized. I know situations never spoken to again by some of the leadership, adult leadership.
Our church is not perfect. But more often than not, like the interactions that I see, more often than not, I think this test. We've got some people working with our youth. We've got some people working with us that I think, on the whole, do a pretty good job of this. But if you can feel tension, then you're seeing what I'm trying to show you. You got to be careful walking this line.
It's the heart of the world. And raising your children.
The first hour put this line up here. I think it was located about here. I think they know everything. Sometimes the people that work with them act as if they think they know everything too. There's a tension. Some of the same characteristics here show up in a way that would never be described by those words. And you got to be careful. But I think on the whole, if you're aware of and thoughtful to this point, opposition may be arising, not always, but it may be arising from the action of God in the heart of another person. And if you deal tenderly, gently with that person, expressing your convictions, you statements, no, I statements, yes. If you express your convictions and express your principles and continue to be open to engagement, God, I think, can work with that and does. Bobby, it looks like you're going to get the last word.
I was thinking when Russell was related to this, is the acceptance of the name and the happiness when he came up with it. If we didn't classify or categorize sin in different degrees and recognize sin for what it is in each and every one of our lives, we would rejoice and party when anybody came to the Lord.
There's little that happens here that's more worth partying and celebrating. I told somebody by the back door of the church on Wednesday night, you walk through a cloud of cigarette smoke toward the Harleys that are out in the parking lot, and if it doesn't make you smile to see that happening, there's something good going on here. There really is. There's some folks coming into our church building on Wednesday nights that I think there's not too many churches in Richmond they'd be willing to walk into. And they walk into our church, and they're glad to be here. And a lot of us are part of that group when they come. It's not a them and us. It's an all of us.
Your assignment for the next time, I don't know if we're going to do one or two of these words, but the next two words we're going to look at, these are the last two of the 14, are good servant and wise servant. Good servant and wise servant. So if you don't have a concordance, go get one. If you don't know what a concordance is, go to a good bookstore and they'll tell you what a concordance is. Do a little work and we'll come back together next week. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the time you've given us, and we thank you for the subject today. Help us understand that it is in the nature of being your servant and being your child that opposition may arise. Help us recognize that when that opposition arises, it is at least possible that it's arising because of work you're doing in the heart of another person. And let us be the kinds of servant that reacts to that opposition with gentleness and with persuasion and with testimony and not with condemnation and exclusion. Help us to be able to work as leaders with those who are newer and perhaps less experienced, but help us recognize that you're calling on the exuberance of youth and of new to make the changes that will take our church into its next phase of growth and life. All these things we pray in your Son's name. Amen.